Welcome to the EdApp Experience Legal Podcast. I'm your host, Deborah Solmore. Today, I'm excited to welcome my guest, Dana Bowen Matthew, the Dean and Harold H. Green Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School. Dean Matthew and I actually tried to connect last week when the decision first came down that we're going to talk about today, but she was in high demand and our schedules didn't align with the holiday weekend. So Dean Matthew, I'm excited to have you here. I'm glad we could finally connect. Welcome.
Deborah, I'm really glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
I see sort of our timing actually as a bit of a silver lining, because last week there was a lot of talk about the affirmative action decision, which is what we're going to talk about today. But I feel like now that we've had a few days since the decision came down, what I really want to talk about with you is sort of, you know, what does the decision mean and what happens now? And I think given the, you know, few days between the decision and today, I think that's a really great opportunity for us to talk about that.
Well, it's a great opportunity to look at what happens now, especially in light of the fact that it seems to me that the popular message about what the court said is really incorrect. What happens now is not the end of affirmative action. That's not what the court did. That's not what the court said. I think more accurately, what happens now is that universities and any institution of higher education has to rethink its race-conscious admissions. That is to say, if you are, as our institution is, committed to a diverse student population, having all perspectives represented and backgrounds represented in your student body, you can no longer do it the way we used to do it before this decision. Those who were particularly focused on race as a plus factor can't do it anymore. Those who had identified the educational benefits of diverse student populations as a constitutionally allowed goal can't do it anymore. We have to serve that same value using other techniques.
I think that's a great summary. So let's back up a little. You mentioned that you thought maybe the way that the holding of the court has been reported in the press may not sort of be accurate. So let's back up and sort of break down a little. From your perspective, what is it that the Supreme Court actually held, and what law is going to control institutions as we move forward?
Supreme Court actually told us that the justification for getting a diverse population that we used to use is no longer constitutionally permissible. So it used to be that we could say, if we were in higher educational, that the educational benefits that flowed from having a diverse class were a constitutionally substantial enough reason for us to consider race in admissions. That used to be enough of a justification. It isn't anymore. The court said, just explaining that the reason you have to consider race in admissions is because of the benefits of diversity, the educational benefits that institutions of higher education see from diversity, that used to be enough. It's no longer enough. In fact, Deborah, it was enough starting in 1978.
So
it was
let,
affirmed,
let
it
me
was
stop.
Affirmed again a number of times. So, not,
so
no longer enough.
Let me stop you for a second, because I think a lot of people in the legal community, lawyers, myself included, would agree that's exactly what happened. But why is it suddenly not enough? Because to your point, it was enough. It was enough. And since my goal here on my podcast is to not sound like a lawyer, I won't give the litany of case names where it was enough. So explain to us how you think the court explained in its decision that it's no longer enough.
Well, you're right to force me to the decision, because there is a short answer about why it isn't enough. But let's look at what the court said about why it wasn't enough. In Maine, it said it was because it can't measure what an educational benefit is. It said it cannot use the justifications that asked us whether or not we were increasing the knowledge and a tolerance for different racial perspectives, that we were creating better leaders, that we were actually preparing people for a pluralist society. Those explanations for the educational benefits were not quantifiable, this court said. It moreover said, we don't know when this ends. We don't know when we have enough understanding, or we have enough representatives from various minorities in a particular field, profession, or area so that we know when we can stop giving racial preference. So this was another area that the court was very upset about the old standard persisting. It didn't like the fact that it didn't end. Another reason the court gave was that the old standard relied on stereotyping. Now, this means the old standard in the court's view lumped all people from a minority group together. It said, if you admit somebody who is Latino, or Native American or African American, you have diversified the perspectives in the classroom. And that, this court said, is a stereotype. It said, it must be assumed, if that's your justification, that all people who are Native American think one way, or all people who are Black think one way. And that stereotyping, this court said, was not permissible. And the reason that the educational diversity justification no longer would prevail. The court had one other reason. The court said a negative use of race harms people if you assume that giving a spot in a university or a college to one person takes away or uses up that spot for another. So another reason that the court said the educational benefit justification is no longer acceptable is because it actually has used race as a negative. It harms non-minorities. So really, the court came down to really, I'd say, three main reasons: no end, negative harm to non-minorities, stereotyping. Those are the three main reasons. But it all, I think, was wrapped up in a package of we just don't know how to measure this benefit that you've given us as a justification.
Imponderable. Right? They said it was imponderable.
Imponderable. There were lots of sort of ephemeral words like imponderable, or the dissent just would have this go on forever. And we just don't understand how that could be. So I have to say, Deborah, that the short answer that can't be avoided when you ask the question, why did this court suddenly feel that educational benefits that flow from diversity were not sufficient, has to include the fact that the composition of the court is now different. In the majority of six justices led by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, there were three relatively new members of the court, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh. All of these are three appointments made since 2017, and those supplied the majority votes in order to reject and overturn this precedent that has existed for decades.
So you gave us sort of a ray of hope at the very beginning of the podcast, which is affirmative action in higher education admissions, not dead. We just have to look at it differently. So after reading the decision and having sort of a few days to ponder, where do you think institutions that currently use, you know, race conscious admissions policies are going to look next? I know a lot of people are talking about that second to last paragraph of the opinion, which says, talk about your individual experiences in an essay. But there's obviously more to it than that. So I'd just be interested in your sort of take on what should admissions teams and institutions be thinking about right now.
Yeah, that second to last paragraph, it should not, Deborah, be read as just change the essay and you'll be fine. The court was really careful saying, you know, no end runs around what we've right. made illegal. You can't make legal indirectly what we've made illegal directly. But let me just focus on the language that everybody is considering, because the short answer is we're figuring it out. We don't know exactly what it means. Now, the court gave us some guidance. So the language that everyone is referring to is this: at the same time, all parties agree that nothing in this opinion should be construed as prohibiting universities from considering an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise. And then the court gave some examples. And I think the real core of those examples is individuality. The core of those examples is that one cannot make a judgment because of the race or the membership of an applicant in a racial group that they're going to make a contribution. That contribution has to be defended and expressed on the basis of the individual's discussion of their race and how it affected them. So here are the two examples the court gave. If race gave that student courage and determination, right? So if what flows from my race, I'm an African-American woman. So if I want to make the argument that it flows from my race, that I am a courageous and determined applicant, and you should accept me on that basis, I think what this court is saying is that my college can consider that for Dana Matthew. How did you become more courageous? Well, I went to a predominantly white school and I was isolated. So I had to muster up a lot of courage in order to go to school every day. Or how did you become more determined? Well, everybody in my neighborhood was Black or Latino, and nobody was getting out without going to jail. I was determined because of my race that I would not be a member of that demographic, right? I'm speaking about myself individually, and that racial connection, not only between myself and my individual experience, but also in terms of what the college is looking for. They want determined people. They want courageous people. And my race has made me that. I think that is what colleges and universities are going to have to find a way to suss out in the process of evaluating students. And they can, this court said, consider race if they do it that way.
And when you say that we're sort of still figuring it out, do you have any initial thoughts about some of the other avenues that schools will be looking at? I thought it was interesting in the opinion, and again, I'm going to take it at face value that, you know, most schools, most institutions do not use race conscious admissions policies. And in sense, one might say the decision impacts a small number of institutions, but yet impacts those institutions where lots of people would love to get their education. So it was interesting. I don't think I had thought about how few institutions might be directly impacted by the ruling.
Well, in a way, every institution is impacted because we're going to have to talk about race in a different context. But you're right. Very few of us are in a position where we were not prepared for this ruling. Let's say it that way. Right. Just as you and I talked about earlier, Deborah, this is a ruling that turns on its head, quite frankly, justification for race-conscious admissions that had been in existence since 1978. The court tried to say it wasn't until 2003 that it adopted that view. Be that as it may, we've also seen that long-standing justification has been challenged over and over and over again in courts, right? So without going through the litany of the number of cases that have discussed, challenged, the number of legislatures, look at Proposition 209 in California. There are 9 states that have outright banned affirmative action. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of schools, lots and lots of states, and higher education institutions have had to think about how not to rely upon race in order to achieve a diverse class. And there are a lot of ways. One could look at socioeconomic status. One could look at zip code. One could look at descendants from immigrants and those individual characteristics. But I find even more compelling and more interesting the ways that medical schools have adjusted their admissions criteria and the things they are seeking from students in order to attract a diverse class of medical students to serve a diverse population of plaintiffs. I take, for example, the California schools that have looked now, instead of at an applicant's race, at an applicant's willing to provide services to underrepresented groups. They've looked at ways to find schools in which people have come from a disadvantaged applicant pool and wrapped mentoring services around that applicant pool. They've looked at ways to find academic support for students who came through a educational system that didn't provide them the kind of courses in their high school and college curricula that they would need. And so they created post-baccalaureate programs. So recognizing some of the social impacts mm-hmm. that would have narrowed the applicant pool to exclude students from disadvantaged backgrounds, filling those gaps, and then attracting those students into the medical student applicant pool has resulted actually in quite a rebound, if you will, following the state legislative ban against affirmative action in the diversity of the pool and the diversity of the health workforce.
That's interesting that you mentioned that. In my non-podcasting world, I was the general counsel of a nonprofit system of colleges and universities, and we recently opened the Kansas College of Osteopathic Medicine in Wichita, Kansas, which is the first osteopathic medicine college in Kansas, period, and the first medical school in Kansas in over 100 plus years. And one of the goals of the Kansas College of Osteopathic Medicine is to increase physicians who will serve in rural Kansas, because it's ranks like 40th per doctors per capita. So it's interesting that you mentioned medical schools, obviously something very near and dear to my heart. But I think, you know, schools will be looking at all areas to try and figure out, because I think you're right, the Supreme Court's decision is not going to decrease commitment to diversity, plain and simple, period, end of sentence.
I think that's clear. I'm really proud of the number of institutions of higher education that have said that. And I'm really more hopeful than the headlines would betray. This court, in my view, has changed the landscape, but not the underlying values that we know will serve our society better. So I'm proud to be a member of the higher education field. I'm proud to be a member of the group of people that will work diligently to continue to provide high quality education. Our social contract, and I'm borrowing this from someone who inspired me a great deal, but our social contract in higher education is that we'll do two things. And we can only do these two things with a diverse student population. Number one, we're going to educate our citizenry so that we have a society that is safe, that is productive, that is economically strong. We exist in order to educate a diverse citizenry. And secondly, we have a duty and obligation to produce new knowledge. Now, I know the court poo-pooed this, but a society that wants, as the United States does, to remain the largest economy in the world, that wants to have health, that wants to have educated, safe population, needs new tools. And that's what higher education does. We can only do it if we're doing it with the entire range of perspectives and needs represented in our student body, in our faculty, and even in our staff.
Your passion is so infectious. I feel like I could sit and talk to you all afternoon long. I love it.
Thank you for saying that. I thank you for saying that. I feel really so deeply for those people who were on the steps of the Supreme Court at the time the decision in the Students for Fair Admissions cases were announced and were in tears. Yeah. I feel deeply for them because they believe that we are at the end of an era, and we are at the end of a chapter in an era. But I still, I'm going to sound very corny here, but it's really apropos to quote Martin Luther King. I believe the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice. It is long, and it is sometime required that many, many, many lives must be brought to bear in order to bend that arc. But it does bend nonetheless, and it bends towards justice. So I do have a lot of hope and a lot of passion.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. And while this would be a great place to end our podcast, I am going to move into one more topic that I wanted to talk about with you. I always like to end on a high note, and that was so inspiring. As a lawyer, every time I read a Supreme Court decision, and some of my friends and colleagues would say I'm probably somewhat of a Supreme Court junkie, every time I read an opinion, I think to myself, okay, well, maybe you answered one question, but you certainly have now created 10 more questions that will come down the pike in the, you know, next few months. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about the question that the court answered, but what did the court leave unanswered? What's coming next? And I know we've already got one Office of Civil Rights complaint filed challenging Harvard's legacy admission. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. But what's coming next? You know, as schools try to look at, you know, how to adapt their admissions policies, what else did the decision sort of raise that we would probably want to talk about?
You know, I want to avoid sounding like a legal geek also, but let me start with the unanswered questions that came from the fact that the court was able to muster a 6-3 majority for the majority opinion, but a lot of people wrote separately. So I think we have, to answer your question directly, we have to ask ourselves what comes next with respect to those individual opinions. Let me cite two of them. First, it was interesting to me that Justice Thomas wrote by himself. He wrote to say in the what I would consider to be the most extreme view of the affirmative action viewpoints that might have been a part of the majority, his concurrence was written separately to explain that there is absolutely no room for affirmative action whatsoever under the Constitution's 14th Amendment. He further said that he wanted to clarify not only that all forms of affirmative action are impermissible under the Constitution, but he also wanted to explain that Grutter was wrong from the beginning. Mm-hmm. That case that said that there was any instance in which we could consider race. So he wanted to distinguish himself from the majority's last two paragraphs. He also said that race in higher education admissions in any way, shape, or form was wrong. And he called this a quote unquote originalist defense of the colorblind Constitution. I do sound like a lawyer here, but let me tell you how important this phrase is. Originalist defense of a colorblind Constitution is a conversation that we are going to hear more about. Why? Because no one agreed with his originalist defense of the colorblind Constitution, but the word colorblind showed up in almost every single one of the opinions, whether they were the majority or dissents. What is a colorblind Constitution? Deborah, that sounds so good. Who wouldn't want to be colorblind? That's the society we're after. Well, we wouldn't have a long enough time in your podcast for me to indicate that Justice Thomas's view that the Constitution can never, ever be thought of to think about race in any way, shape, or form was not held by Justices Sotomayor in her dissent or Justice Jackson in her dissent. And I don't believe it's even held by Chief Justice Roberts in his majority opinion, because there is so much history recounted by Justices Jackson and Sotomayor that confirms that when the 13th Amendment was written, when parts of the Constitution were written, when the 14th Amendment was written, it was all about correcting racial discrimination. The Constitution was anything but colorblind, say Justices Sotomayor in their historical account and Jackson in their historical account. So we're going to hear more about this idea that the Constitution can't think about race at all. That's coming. Make no mistake about it. And then I want to point out what I think was a really important second concurrence that was solo authored, and that was Justice Gorsuch's concurrence that focused on Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Again, don't want to sound too much like a lawyer, but that's the big civil rights legislation that Congress passed in 1964 to say anyone who receives federal funds cannot discriminate based on color, race, or national origin. Big statute. It protects against discrimination anytime you spend federal dollars. Justice Gorsuch, all by himself, nobody agrees with him, says, you know what? Not only is affirmative action illegal under the Constitution's 14th Amendment, but it's also illegal under Title VI. That's a bombshell. That's a huge expansion of what the court actually said in the majority. Now, these two justices wrote by themselves, we're going to have to see whether anybody's going to join them to go after other race conscious expansions of this court's decision. So those are two things that are coming next, just based on the language of the suit. Now, I don't know if you still want me to talk about the complaint that was filed in the Department of Education. That's another thing we can expect.
Yeah, I think that we should talk a little bit about that, because I think once the decision came out, people started going at, well, what about legacy? What about athletes? What about, you know, sort of all these other categories of students that were getting preferential treatment? So I thought it was interesting that, you know, the day before our Independence Day holiday, this got filed. So why don't you give us just a little background? And if you wouldn't mind, sort of talk a little bit about, you know, this is not a lawsuit. This is not a case that was filed in court, similar to the decision we're talking about. This was filed with the Department of Education in their Office of Civil Rights, which is something different. So I'll be quiet now and sort of let you
go. No, you've actually explained it. So we have three branches of government, and one of them is the courts, and that's where the decision we've been talking about has bubbled up. It's percolated. It was a plaintiff filed against a defendant, and lots of judges listened to it until the Supreme Court got to make a decision. That's our judicial branch. The complaint that was filed just before it in the 4th of July was filed in the Department of Education. And the Department of Education is actually a branch of our executive government. So that's think about it as the president's government. So there are agencies, and one of them is dedicated to educational policy. And in that agency, educational policy includes civil rights. So the complaint was filed by three groups that are basically asking the Department of Education to opine on whether or not Harvard has discriminated against Black, Hispanic, and Asian students by admitting less qualified white students in their preferences given to athletes and legacy admissions, alumni donors, people who are connected and who the college may admit be based on those connections, says this complaint, more than based on their actual qualification. So this is another way of saying what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If you are going to say that the Supreme Court is going to say that a college or a university who admits based on preferences due to people's experiences by virtue of their racial background is illegal, why then is it not also illegal to admit people based on a preference, not based on their qualifications, for their financial background or their familial background or their athletic prowess? There is a book, you probably have heard of it, When Affirmative Action Was White. And it is an argument, if you will, that universities and colleges have reached for specific groups of people apart from a notion of a quote unquote merit-based or meritocracy since they were established. And I can tell you as the dean of an institution that admits people every year, we seek to put together a class of students. Now, of course, we absolutely are dedicated to analyzing each student in that class individually, but we are looking to put together an entire class that includes a fabric of different voices, perspectives, experiences, because that is part of the training. That is part of the experience that makes one ready to become a lawyer, to solve big problems, to cross divides, to have civil conversation about societal issues that must be solved if you're going to be a lawyer of any use to society. So when we put together a class, we reach for people based on their rural background, based on their political background, based on their military background, and based on their legacy. That is that their parents and their parents' parents and their parents' 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 parents were part of our institution. And this is a complaint that says you're taking up space by giving those preferences to people based on their donations, people based on their legacies, and most of those people are white. And we have the data to show that they are. So if you're gonna give us a hard time about compiling a class that's diverse from a racial standpoint. You can't pick a category that favors whites.
Well, if that's okay with you, I'm going to leave it at that. This was a fabulous discussion. I can't thank you enough. And as I said, your passion for all of this is really simply infectious.
I'm really glad that we had a chance to talk, Deborah. Thanks for the opportunity. And it is an exciting time to be in education.
I wholeheartedly agree with that. Thank you again, Dean Matthew.